This is a Beyond Casterbrus podcast. Available on iTunes, Audio Boom, Stitcher.com, Player FM, and BeyondCasterbrus.com.
Podcast with a K. I'm Christian Corley. With me this week is James McLean. Hello, James.
Hello.
And our guest is our favourite guest, probably. It's Gareth Cavanagh. Hello, Gareth.
Oh, hello. Hello. Welcome back.
Welcome back to you.
Well, you've been in my show for years, but you haven't realised it. I just take a few months off.
I see. So I'm in your show. It's funny because I look at life like it's my own personal show as well.
Yeah. Occasionally, I'm only a sort of supporting artiste in my own life, but I suppose that happens to all of us, doesn't it?
Yes, that's true. True enough.
Yeah, I'm the antagonist in mine. Which is
yes.
Oh, brilliant, brilliant. Now, Gareth is a Doctor Who fan. He's a producer and other things. I imagine he'd probably make quite a good raconteur later in life as well.
Well, I'm racking up some good tales. Yes,
I
that's
bet,
for sure.
Yes, I bet.
The problem I get is that most of my tales are told me down the pub. So when I get home, I've only got a sort of sketchy 24% recall of them. And I wonder if this is where most of the best Doctor Who rumours arise, when people get home having been told something sizzling and then realise they can only remember about 18% of it. So, you know, it's like Superman 3, where he can't work out what that secret ingredient of kryptonite is, so he just adds tar.
Yeah.
Sorry, are we talking about the characters or the writer? See what I'm doing there, no?
Oh, very good. Very good.
You mischief. One of the other things that Gareth Cavanagh does is... I don't know what the best word is.
Publish.
Publish, yeah, I suppose it's published. Yeah.
And
I use this word with full confidence that I'm using it accurately, because I truly believe it is seminal Doctor Who fanzine, Vwop Vwop. Although, really, more strictly speaking, it's a Doctor Who magazine fanzine. And we finally made it to issue 3. It's currently available to order for release in, I think, March.
Yes, it's available for pre-order now, and it'll be shipping in March. In reality, there isn't a chance it'll be shipping by the end of February. Now it's going to be March.
We've talked about this before, and it has had a long gestation, hasn't it?
It has. There's about three or four different points in the past 6 years when we could have conceivably probably published Vwop Vwop.
So hang on, is it six years since the last one?
Yeah. Broadly. Oh no, or is it five and a half? You know, it's
good lord.
It's certainly it's one doctor ago. It's one doctor ago. It's two prime ministers ago. So yeah, it's about 5.5 years.
Wow.
So there were points where we could have published. We very nearly went very quickly in 2012, and then we didn't. I think there were personal things going on in one or both of our lives that meant that we didn't finish it. Then we nearly went in 2013 for the 50th anniversary, and that was a very different Vwop Vwop. And there's a lot of stuff that's been lost in that incarnation.
Will we ever see it?
I don't know. There was going to be some lovely stuff. Colin might have some stuff on his hard drives. We were going to basically focus on every single Doctor in order and go through each of their eras and then have some feature stuff. So there is stuff that will appear in later issues. We did a lot of stuff with John Ridgway. That'd be for the Sixth Doctor. And we were going to have Steve Parkhouse chat, and we were going to have a chat to some of the artists from the Fifth Doctor era. There was all sorts of goodies for each one. We were going to do a brand new TV comic Hartnell strip, and I think we had a script for one of the writers of note who was still with us from that era. And I remember this well because he made me pay for his script, because he said, "I'm an old professional, I won't do anything unless you pay." "Oh, that's fine. How would you like paying? PayPal, backs, no, check." And I went, "Well, I don't have a checkbook. You know, I'll need a time machine to get a checkbook." "No, it must be check." So, and it was only a very modest amount. Well, I did mention postal order, and he wasn't keen on that. I was going to have to post
a paper.
This sounds like someone who likes to cash checks in bars to me.
Sounds like something.
It does sound a bit like that. It was a very modest amount, and I remember thinking. Anyway, the irony being, after all this, because that particular incarnation of Warp was lost in the Time War, we never did anything with it. So we still have that script, but we never did the strip. Then we did all sorts of stuff with Russell T. Davis and the Time War, and that all had to go because we did. I said, I've always been very fond of a one-page piece of prose that Russell did, I think, for the 2005 annual, where he talks about the Time War and how it came about and the You Are Not Alone and all that. It's quite a, you know, it's almost like his development notes that he's quickly sort of pulled them together into a bit of prose for the kids, and there was a lot in there. So I said, well, why don't we do a strip based on that? So I asked Russell. Russell said, yes, you can do it, but obviously it won't be official, but yes, do it. That's fine. He said, and then we carried on with that for a little bit, and Jim Mortimer did the script, and we started looking at artists, and then he said, this is all very good, but I think in the script we had shown which Doctor was going to activate the moment and end the Time War, because at that time we only had little sort of snippets. That he wasn't just pressing a big red button that says moment, you know, like Davros's total destruct button in Genesis the Daleks. It was like the plucking of a rose. But I think in the script we showed it as being Eccleston that did it, and Russell said, no, you know, you can't do that. I've always maintained that I will never ever show the Doctor that does that. I've always left it open, so you don't know if it's the eighth, the ninth, someone else. He said, I won't show it. And the other thing he said, and the other problem with that, he says, I've actually written The Last Day of the Time War as a piece of prose, and it's going to be in the Doctor Who, the legend, you know, the big book for the year. He said, and unfortunately my canon will outweigh yours, so you might want to rethink your ending. And then of course, a couple of months roll on, Dave the Doctor's announced, and then it's like, oh, well, bugger, well, we definitely can't use that. So that's something else lost in the Time War. So something else lost in the Time War is actually Russell's original Time War ending, Last Day, which would be pretty good.
So that's the old Warp issue 3.
That's the old Warp. And then it sort of goes into... Yeah, so we've got all these sort of, you know, aborted reboots. Then it gets to... Then in early 2014, I leave the pub, so my life is like a sort of, you know, wrecked wasteland financially for about a year. So perhaps not the most fertile ground to be sort of working on a fanzine, but we continue to tinker on it. And then actually, early last year, we just finally got off our arse and said, you know what, let's just do it. So we just started writing and we got on with it.
Was there an aspect of this of just kind of trying too hard, perhaps, into conceptually, and rather than just getting on with it, as you said?
I think part of it is that Colin and I were pulling in different directions.
Right.
I think it's probably fair to say. We like different things, which actually, when you can get that chemistry to work, makes for a very, very... potent and creative blend. But when you're going in different directions, you can't move forward. So we managed to sort of agree on what we were going to do and the approach. And the main thing that we changed is that we changed the joint editor credit. And that actually was, I think that was the main turnkey that did it. So I became the publisher. Mm-hmm. So we still work on things conceptually. We still, you know, basically there's a top table and there's me and Colin at it, and we debate and argue and enthuse each other what we're going to do. And then once we've set the brief and the idea, and then we carry on talking. It's Lucas Spielberg on the Indiana Jones films. I said that to Colin the other night, and he said, "Well, I don't want to be Lucas." I said, no, you're not Lucas. Don't worry. I'm Lucas. sat there on my pile of cash in my money bin. eating Twinkies.
With your license.
So the main thing is it works, and I think we've produced something of real quality.
Okay.
And it's much easier now because everyone knows where they stand in a sort of, you know, I don't commission articles, for instance. I'll have people come to me and now I go, that's great, go to Colin.
Right.
So it means that we're not sort of going in separate directions. We're working together as one. Now, I will pass stuff on to Colin, or I'll say, how about we look at this? And he'll go, oh, yes or no, or, oh, that's good. How about this? Or how about this writer? And I'll say, oh, yeah, that's good, but how about this artist? And much, much better. Okay. Much better.
Okay. So how long is issue 3?
Oh, it's 208 pages. It's bloody huge.
So is that's about double the length, or is it 3 times length?
It's more or less double the length of issue 1, and it's about 50% longer than issue 2. I must admit, it's a big issue. It's a big, big issue. So people are going to get very good value for money on that one.
And I mean, if someone listening who isn't aware of what's inside, what are the highlights as far as you're concerned?
Well, we've sort of broadened the mission a bit because it sort of started out. Warp started out a magazine celebrating the Doctor Who comic and Doctor Who magazine. Mm. Now we've kind of segued into.
Are you there?
Seem to have lost him.
Because it gives us much more breadth. But the highlights is clearly Alan Moore talking about Doctor Who and his thoughts on old Doctor Who, new Doctor Who, his 5 interesting backup strips. Yeah, I'm still here. That's a great highlight. There's tons of stuff on TV21 Daleks, and we complete Ron Turner's final strip, which did the first 2 pages for in 97. DWM decided they didn't want the strip, so they declined the cushion. So he just never finished it, and then he died 6 months later. So Lee Sullivan's completed that from the original script. Just every page will have something lovely on it. I think probably my favourite page in the whole thing is a little chat I had with Andrew Cartmell, where we talked about Alan Moore's Halo Jones and how influential that is on the 7th Doctor era and Ace. And the more I looked at it and the more I spoke to him, the more I realised that Ace is actually Halo Jones. This, you know, we meet her as this bored waitress on a space station, which is Halo Jones. And the whole tenor of it and tonally, you know, Paradise Towers has a lot to do with Halo Jones, but one, I think Ace's journey is Halo's journey. So I think that was a nice piece. I think, and there's a bit of art which I'm going to ask Colin to blow up. And I said to Colin, I said, you know what I'd love for this? I said, I'd like us to design a Radio Times cover as if BBC Two had adapted Halo Jones in 1988. So he said, oh, yeah, great. He said, we'll have to pick a Halo. So we argued over who would be Halo. And we had all sorts of interesting ideas, sort of, you know, Mary the Punk from EastEnders. All sorts. And you know, my argument was that the BBC would cast someone actually at that time, they'd have cast someone much older who they would think could play 16, but was actually nearer probably 31. And Colin went, no, they'd go for young and spiky. So in the end, we asked Cartmell, and Cartmell said, oh, I know straight away who I would have picked. It would be Charlotte Coleman, who is brilliant. So there's this little cover, and it's only tiny, so I think we should blow that up. So that's in there. Yeah, that's probably my favourite page. Truth be told.
Okay. There's a cover
that's one
gift
out to
as well, isn't there?
There is. We got quite well known for free gifts because the first free gift was a set of transfers.
Yeah.
And the irony is, lots of people still have the transfers attached to their covers. They don't work anymore. They've kind of dried out.
Oh no.
So, should have used them in 2009. They weren't brilliant to start with in 2009, but they certainly don't work now. Then we did the Vorpabix games in 2000 in issue two, which was fun, fun stuff. And then this time round, I said, I want to do a record. And originally it was going to be a flexi disc, which homaged the Doctor Who magazine gift from the Absent Art one. And then when we looked at it, it actually became easier and cheaper to do it as a sort of proper 7-inch vinyl record. So that's what we've done. So we've adapted The Mechanical Planet. So we've done a homage to The Mechanical Planet, which is a story from the 1965 Dalek World Annual, I think. And yeah, we've done a full cast proper audio. So Alan Stevens, it's basically the Caldor City team have done it. So Alan Stevens adapted it and then Alistair Locke directed it and audio mastered it. It's beautiful. And we've got the great David Graham back playing a Dalek for the first time since 1966. He's the Golden Emperor of the Daleks.
Now, I had a tangential connection to this.
Oh, yes.
Because, if I recall correctly, someone was trying to get in touch with David Graham. I think it was Alan Stevens. My cousin is a sound producer at Whistledown, who do various things on Radio 2 and Radio 4. And he gave me the email address. But by the time that he'd done that, and I forwarded it to Alan, he'd already got in touch with him. So, and I should add, my cousin is Nigel Appleton. He does a fantastic impersonation of Parker.
Does he?
He does. Always has done.
Well, do you know, David is lovely. He's 93. He's spry, he's bright. And the recording was down in Brighton. He came down on the train. We cabbed him there. He worked all afternoon in his studio session like an absolute trooper. He played the president, Sorvad. Now, that isn't us doing a rubbish Davros anagram. That's Terry doing a rubbish Davros anagram in 1965. So that isn't us. And he plays the Golden Emperor. And he worked his socks off all afternoon. Lovely man, and, you know, full of life, full of energy. And I think, and I spoke to someone about this, they said, oh, that's odd, because we wanted him in stuff 10, 15 years ago, and he turned down in his 70s, said he was too old. So I think coming back to Thunderbirds in the animated series has completely rejuvenated him, and he was great.
Well, so, yeah, there's probably also the other thing that he does that younger viewers will know about. Which is
Grandpa Pig.
Well, you say Grandpa Pig, and Grandpa Pig's all very well, but it's actually his magic is actually in, appropriately enough, is the wise old elf in Ben and Holly's Little Kingdom. Because he's absolutely.
I'll take your word for that.
Pull it up on YouTube, or just stick Milkshake on one morning and wait for Ben and Holly to come on. He is so dry as the wise old elf. He's absolutely brilliant. So funny.
Well, he's like that in real life.
Right.
I mean, it was quite funny, but he sort of went with it when I first met him. We got a full size Golden Emperor Dalek there, which
right.
A chap Phil Stevens has built. It's beautiful, and we had it there for photos. And when he turned up, and I said to him, I said, "Right, what we're going to do, David, is we're going to take the top off. We'd like to pop in, pop inside. We're going to mic it up, and we want you to record everything from within there for total, you know, for total method authenticity."
What did he say to that?
And he just sort of looked at me and started to make a move for the Dalek. And I went, no, only joking. No, have a cup of tea. No, we just want a picture of you with it. a proper pro. No, I've had a few people say, "Oh yeah, Grandpa Peppa Pig, amazing. Grandpa Pig, he's the boss." I'm not aware of his work in that either. Is it good?
Well,
is it Peppa dry? Pig,
well, I'm not so keen. Yeah, it's kind of similar because they use the same voices across both shows as well for the grown-ups.
Right.
But Ben and Holly's Little Kingdom is a better thing, in my opinion.
Oh.
It's just a bit more, you know, Peppa Pig, you know, everyone talks about Peppa Pig, oh, Grandpa Pig, Daddy Pig, Mummy Pig. But Ben and Holly's Little Kingdom's just a little bit more amusing and a little cleverer. It's more for adults, I think. Or maybe it's more sophisticated. Maybe it is. Maybe it's the Fawlty Towers to the Only Fools and Horses. It's less populist.
I got you. Got you. Well, you see, because I don't have my own piglets, so I don't watch any of
television. Well, I try and steer them away from commercial television anyway, because adverts are a danger to parents.
What?
Well, no. What? So children see things on the telly and adverts. Oh, no, now I'm going to have to buy that. Oh, no, now I'm going to have to buy that. But if you just keep them watching CBeebies, then you know there's no adverts, you see. So they're getting good educational stuff from people like Maddie Moe. James McLean is very quiet. I wonder, James, if you have any questions for Gareth concerning the genesis of a fanzine.
No, well, I absolutely disagree with you. I think adverts are part and parcel of being a child. And
I think they are, but not when you're five. I think maybe when you're 8 or 9, yeah, but not when you're five.
It's part of our cultural connection, you know. It's
just a very, very bad parent, Christian.
You're not
indulging your kids in the this sort of neoliberalist approach of upbringing kids that benefits the economy of our free trade society.
Yeah, like most people, I have no idea what you're talking about.
No, nor do I. I'm just making up words. No, I just remember as a kid, I just used to love adverts. I used to love it. And you're right. Yeah, it does. Mm. It is bad for parents. But I mean, I you remember all those Star Wars adverts when I was a kid?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think they were good. And I used to love the Transformers adverts. But, you know, I wasn't five then. I was like 8 or 9. And I think there's...
Shaken back,
absolutely.
Well, you know, in those days, you can get these old adverts on YouTube, right? You can sit and watch them for... I think you've shared them before on Facebook.
Mm.
You can sit and watch old adverts for hours and hours on end. And I used to, you know, you record old Bond movies on TV in like 1983, 84, whatever, and you see all these great old adverts.
That's the thrilling bit, the contextuality,
But they're not TV. Exactly, it's those adverts. Yeah. It's not the kids' toys adverts. It's those. It's like it's your Hamlets and your Skull and your Tetris and, you know, the bloke
calling Black Label
with the dog and getting a pint of whatever it was and all that stuff.
Hamlet.
The local furniture store having a carpet sale or whatever, and it's all animated. Or your local caravan store.
Yeah. This is all very interesting, but you are obviously you're distracting and you're taking us way off base from the question you asked me.
Yes, go for it.
And you've gone off on this weird tangent. Well, I have a question, but you seem to be interested in adverts.
Ask it.
I was just going to ask Gareth, do you personally and honestly, do you feel any sort of devaluing in the name of the fanzine, or would you like to see a new category, or would you feel that this is a little more than a fanzine, or do you feel like you wish to be amongst the marketplace that has the bric-a-brac of fan creative talent? Where do you stand?
Oh gosh, well that's a big question.
It is.
I think the answer is I'm very happy to be a fanzine, and I think that people get a little bit too attached to the tattiness of some of the early fanzines. And there is some absolute gold in some of those early fanzines, but people were still trying to push the envelope with them. I remember when I first did fanzines in sort of early 90s, to get a colour cover was the absolute zenith. You know, the fact that we then made the jump to word processing, then we made the jump to some of the very early sort of desktop publishing packages. I think fanzines have always been at the leading edge. I think it's only a little bit more notable with Warp Warp because we have such high production standards, because that evolutionary sort of escalator stops at about the sort of late 90s, early 2000s, because people, as the internet comes online, people aren't making fanzines as much. They're actually engaging with the internet, so it's blogging, and you know, people will, instead of writing a nice article on why Mordrian Undead doesn't make sense, will engage with other people online. Now, I think that trad aspect of fanzines, which is reviews, retrospectives, has gone. So fanzines have to do something different, but I'm still happy to be within the fanzine category, albeit at the luxury end of the fanzines.
That still interests me, because there is a weird thing with fanzines, because there is a sort of devalue. does it to some, does the label to some degree devalue some of the, I mean, because you have a lot of people who get involved in this who are professionals. Does that in some way devalue or even mystify or hide that sort of level of quality? And at the same time, while fanzines do, anything with that fan attached has a sort of slight devaluement. At the same time, when you look at sort of, as you say, the history of fanzines within this sector, there is actually a lot of, you know, like DWB, there is actually a lot of quality that has been in that sort of, in the Who culture through fanzine. And obviously creative talent like Moffat, you know, who was playing out with sort of writing fan fiction and the like in the 80s. So it has credibility, but in a sense, does it sort of hide or even not do justice to the sort of people who are involved?
I think you're right. I think the category has changed. I think if you went back, probably the high point of fanzine culture is probably the 80s, I would have thought. Mid to late 80s, which is where, you know, you couldn't move for fanzines. There was probably every single little group of fans and friends probably had at least three issues of a fanzine in them. They're fascinating. Now, I think in terms of fanzines, there's us, and we publish irregularly. Issue four will not be 5.5 years. It'll be quicker, I can guarantee that. But still, you're not going to see one every couple of months. Nothing at the end. Richard Bignall's excellent Nothing at the End of the Lane probably publishes, you know, on a similar sort of thing to us every sort of, the intention is every 2-3 years. I can't think of many others. So it is difficult, really. It's almost like, I know people have said prozine, but prozines tend to be, that suggests that, I don't know, maybe we are, maybe we're not, or maybe we're just happy to sit in a category of our own. Maybe, you know, within the fanzine class, there's just, you know, we're all fanzines. It's just, they're all a bit different. What I have noticed with fanzines is the ones that are still here and are probably being sought after the most, so ourselves and Nothing at the End of the Lane, is that we're bringing new knowledge to the table, new insight, new interviews, new archive material, new old knowledge, of which there isn't a great deal left. You know, the tube of toothpaste has been pretty well squeezed over the years, and so the fact that we're able to bring new insights and that we focus on our own little particular niche, and in the case of Doctor Who magazine and the comics and art and all those sub-niches, it's a relatively underexplored niche, means that I would say, yes, we're still a fanzine. I don't think we would survive on the shelves of Smith's, not from a quality perspective. We'd just be too niche. So has that sort of answered your question? That we're sort of, we're proud fanzines, but we recognise that we're at the luxury end.
It's one of those dangerous things, because I would almost just say that you're sort of almost like you'd say an indie magazine, but then if you do that, you end up in the question of copyright legalities, as soon as your name suggests that you're something more than your fan ownership.
We don't have an ISBN number. We're not going to be in the British Library anytime.
So it's not quite independent, but independent seems to sort of fit the bill in some ways a little more than fan, just because of those mutable classifications at the moment. At the moment, sort of has fans sort of associated with, I suppose, unofficial works, but it doesn't tend to have the new criteria. It doesn't have that sort of new criteria that Vorp has. Fanzines tend to be sort of, as you say, retrospective, while Vorp is actually, a lot of it is tends to be quite a lot of new content. New content within the canon of the...
That's right. And I think the minute that we start just, running Terence Dix interviews because we bumped into him in the pub and he seemed quite chatty... you know, or we just happen to be sort of just interviewing people for the sake of it because we've bumped into them. I think that's when you'll know that we've jumped the shark. But I'm glad that we've broadened it considerably, because I think there's a lot more to be written about fan culture, other fanzines, art, artists, Doctor Who magazine itself. There's still a lot to be explored, fortunately, so I don't think we're going to run out of material soon. But you're right, it's every time we put something in, we've got to be convinced that it's worth putting in, that it's going to move the dial in some way, or that it's someone who we think has something interesting still to say, or hasn't been spoken to at all. And the other thing, of course, is the bloody Grim Reaper, because a lot of the people we've spoken to since we started this project aren't with us and have gone at shockingly young ages. So Steve Dillon and Steve Moore and some of these other people who aren't gone. And in the cases of some of these people, it was the only time they ever really talked about that work in detail. So there is, it's satisfying in a way when you get to someone who you've wanted to speak to for a long time and you know hasn't really covered this work in great detail. I mean, Alan Moore, for instance, I was convinced that Alan Moore would not remember a thing about these strips, I'll be quite honest. And perhaps it's because of his publicity photos. He always looks like an incredibly scary, intense Rasputin-type figure. Mm-hmm. I was convinced it was going to be like a sort of a brutal interrogation.
Well, it's the Peter Green / Sid Barrett sort of... Trumpy, solitary, living as a hermit sort of look, isn't it?
It's an intensity. It's a vast intensity. It's a bit like I met Terry Pratchett once, and I spoke to him. It was backstage at an event, and I spoke to him, and he evaluated me in the first 2 minutes that we spoke to see if I was worth speaking to, and I clearly was failing badly at this point. And he just sort of beamed his laser eyes at me and just almost like he was sort of like just working out if I was worth continuing the conversation for a current minutes or whether he was going to just turn round. And then I mentioned about how my partner works in dementia and we had a 5 minute conversation about dementia. And then when we'd exhausted the dementia conversation, that he then did turn around, get a cup of tea and bugger off. And I thought, my God, it's going to be like a sort of a telephone version of this. And, you know, Alan, one of the reasons I think Alan is incredibly misunderstood is because he looks so scary and intense in those pictures. When you speak to him, I mean, first, the voice is so warm and it's a sort of warm Northampton, rounded kind of speech. He's generous with his conversation. But yeah, we had a dream conversation for over an hour and he remembered things in absolute detail. It was amazing. And then by the same chalk, people who'd worked on it more recently had a very funny chat with Paul Cornell about Emperor of the Daleks, and his recall was terrible on it, as he freely admitted. He said, my God, I can barely remember anything about this.
She's good.
30 years on. So it's you never know what you're going to get. But yeah, Alan was a nice surprise.
You've been producing... publishing and editing and writing fanzines for a long time, but when did it all start?
Well, actually, you say that I came to fanzines fairly late. I did my first fanzine work on Black Scrolls in about 1993.
Okay,
I missed out on the whole 80s sort of fanzine thing because growing up in rural North Wales, there wasn't really a sort of Doctor Who fan culture. I think the fanzines tend to come out of the areas where there was a rich fan culture, where they all met up and then they all went and wrote and then they met up and they wrote. So Bristol, you see a lot of fanzines coming out of Bristol, out of London, you know, all those sort of hubs of fandom. Atlantid, though, sadly wasn't one.
It's nearly 25 years, though, so it is a while.
It is a while, I suppose. Yes. Yes, so that's how I started out. I think my first ever fanzine article was a defence of The Underwater Menace, which I said was great. And I said, I reckon if someone can just find one more episode of this behind a cupboard in Hong Kong somewhere, we'll all go, it's great. And I'm sort of half right.
Do you stand by that?
I do, actually. I do. I have a feeling that if part four turned up, everyone would go, yeah, you know, this is quite good. This is quite good. It's got one quite loud performance in it, which, depending on how you like those loud performances, I think coloured your whole opinion of The Underwater Menace. But I quite like Zaroff. I think he's ace.
Well, we don't get them anymore, do we?
No, we don't. We don't. Evil has become quite sort of banal and rubbish nowadays. It's one thing that the new series has always failed to do.
Mm.
I think Van Staten was probably the closest to an old school villain that I can think of in the whole run.
I think David. I'm one of those terrible mind block moments. Dinosaurs on a Spaceship.
Oh yeah. Old Burkov.
No, that was Power of Three. That was a Power of Three.
Oh, Power of Three. Yeah, Foolish. Yeah, he's the closest in that. He's quite close.
That was Burkov, but no, in Dinosaurs on the Spaceship, it was
it's what's his name?
Game of Thrones, Harry Potter.
Bloke who played Hartnell.
Yes,
David
him.
Bradley.
Yes. Bradley, thank you, David Bradley. Yes. He's good in there as well, but on the whole, I think Burkov was a missed opportunity. It's basically Davros and the Master do the arch stuff. Gate is kind of close, I think, in the Series 7 episode.
And what's he playing that?
It's one of those... what the hell are we... Are we Doctor Who fans?
We've not been paying much attention, have we?
The Lazarus Experiment.
Oh, he's quite good in that. Yeah, he's
but
quite good.
But on the whole, I would absolutely agree, and I think I've done a podcast about this in the past, that there is a distinct lack of arch-villainy in Doctor Who since 2005.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, we spend all this time focusing on the Doctor and the Companion and that, when what we really need is some Harrison Chases.
Oh, completely.
Zarkovs.
You know. Yeah. Yeah, completely. It's exactly what you need. You need some really good, high quality, slightly unhinged, totally over the top, well written, lightness of touch. We just don't get that anymore. I wonder if it's to do with the generation of writers that we have now. That there's a new paradigm of villainy, that villainy is seen as almost a combination of incompetence and all sorts of other things. It's not sort of evil for its own sake. Yeah, interesting.
Mm, yes, indeed. So going back to the point, you have what we should probably call a legacy of fanzines.
Yeah.
As well as a litany as well.
Yes.
Which is a nice Doctor Who pun, which someone should work into a discussion on Attack of the Cybermen at some point.
they should, yes.
Yeah, they definitely should. Yeah. But what I wanted to say is, I've had some involvement in your work in the past. Yeah. And I'm interested to know, and this is difficult, so I don't want to say it, so like Gareth Cavanagh, give us your top 10 tips for creating a new fanzine, but what have you learned over the years with developing fanzines?
Passed on
to anyone listening who's thinking, I want to do a fanzine, what do I do?
Oh, dead easy. There's a few things that definitely, I think, make for a good fanzine. The first is to continually push the envelope. So like what I was saying, that... You know, I remember when I pushed for our first colour covers of Black Scrolls, and then when we brought it back, I pushed for a sort of colour and glossy throughout. Mm. And then the last one, I pushed for that CD-ROM with all the goodies on,
yeah.
And that was in 2005. I mean, in fact, that was still well ahead of its time. So I think I've always pushed for a point of difference and something that would insanely excite me. So whether it's a set of transfers, so... Having a point of difference and a free gift is a good way around that because free gifts are not that difficult. And we're still talking about crazy free gifts for like future ones. And we never quite agree on it, but we come close occasionally. So point of difference with a free gift is one. The second one, and I think this is the most important, I would be tempted to pick a niche which is underexplored, relatively speaking, but has enough people behind it that it should be interesting. So, for instance, it's 10 years of Sarah Jane Adventures, isn't it?
Probably is, speaking. Yeah.
I'd go, well, Sarah Jane, a little bit underexplored. Let's look at that. So you would look to go, right, so you'd aim high, so you'd go, right, let's see if we can speak to Russell. Let's speak to Gary Russell. Let's speak to Phil Ford. So let's speak to all these people and get a retrospective, because DWM should be doing that, but won't. Let's look, see if we can get a comic strip together. Let's see if there's any material that would be interesting, which is unpublished. So are there any, you know, let's look at that final season that they were filming when Liz Sladen died, which they didn't complete. Are there any scripts, storyline? Is there any images or material that we can share that's never been seen? So I'd be looking at that. I'd be looking at all those sort of things. I'd be looking to see what we could pull together that no one has seen before, or bringing new perspectives. And I'm continually buying bundles of old fanzines in the 70s, from the 70s and early 80s in particular, because I think that's the golden age. It's sometimes you turn up something which is really fascinating. And the things that I like, which I think is another thing that fanzines do well and can do, is you'll suddenly read an in-depth description of a fanzine, of a convention. So I got a 1979 fanzine, and there's a brilliant, absolutely brilliant in-depth write-up of the Panopticon of that year, which is about the second or third.
Right.
And there's a grumpy Tom Baker there, there's Graham Williams there, there's Des Skins there showing off his dummy and announcing Doctor Who Weekly. All wonderful little moments of time, which if that person hadn't written it down, would be completely lost to us. So priceless. And then you'll turn the page and there'll be a Valentine Dial interview, like a little short one. Lots of people who are no longer with us, or a Bob Holmes interview. Bob Holmes seems to do a lot of little interviews for fanzines in the late 70s and early 80s. He seems right. to be quite okay with that. So there is, you know, there's Jackie Hill interviews. There's all sorts of interviews out there of people who leave us far too soon, and who Doctor Who magazine hasn't necessarily picked up on at that time. You know, for instance, I think Doctor Who magazine only interviews Innes Lloyd once or twice. You know, and he's an enormous figure that we know very little about. You know, there's Graham Williams is only interviewed, I think, twice or maybe once. So fanzines are these little repository of knowledge and goodness, and we should treasure them. But the good ones are the ones that are doing something different, in my opinion.
Okay.
Things that Doctor Who magazine would never be able to devote the pages to, but would like to if they could. And I think that should always be the good starting point for a fanzine, is what would they do if they had the time and the money and the ability and the page count to do it?
Good answer. Listen, we're running out of time. So, sadly... I might add, but we've obviously got Vought Vought 3's coming along very shortly. It's available for pre-order now at vaughtvaught.co.uk.
It is.
Is there... Sorry, do carry on.
I was going to say that at the time of speaking, we've cover C, which is the TV21 cover that has the record with it, is out of stock at the moment. We might have a few left over once I've done the final stop tape reconciliation, but as of now, that is sold out. But you've still got beautiful cover A and cover B, which is Martin Geraghty's Business as Usual and Aid Salmon's Black Legacy, EC Comics homage, which is beautiful, work of art. And both of those have got the CD of The Mechanical Planet, so you don't miss out, David Graham.
Okay, excellent. Now, question. Is there going to be a VV4?
Yeah. Oh, yes, there is. Colin's already got stuff lined up. We've had stuff banked for a long time in various bits and bobs, and there's still stuff to do. I've still got... There's a couple of big fish I'm looking to hook for that, which I can't say any more. Although Russell T. Davis, when I saw him before Christmas, did say, yes, I will speak to you this time, because we wanted to speak to him a few years ago, and he said the time isn't right. But he said, yes, I think I'll speak to you now. I wanted to speak to him really about his love of comics, because he's obviously a big 2000 AD reader, or has been, and that's there in things like Gridlock. He obviously loves the Doctor Who magazine comic, always has done, and that's there infusing a lot of his stuff. And indeed how the comic sat with the show and vice versa and all of the considerations, because he was a great supporter of it. So I think it would be nice to have that kind of conversation. And hopefully we can get that sorted. And a couple of other, like I say, a couple of other big fish we're angling for, but I can't say any more about.
Lovely. Okay, that's great. Well, you know, we're not going to be talking about that for a while yet, because we've got a new VV, a new Warp Warp, issue 3, available not on newsstands, but at warpwarp.co.uk.
Indeed.
And
yes.
Yeah, if you're a fan of Doctor Who, Doctor Who magazine, anything related to Doctor Who and comic strips, or just the show itself, you should pretty much be buying this. It promises to surpass the previous two. I consider to be quite outstanding issues, particularly the first one.
Oh, I think this one knocks them into a cocked hat.
I thought you might
although
say.
There are bits of them, there's bits of one I still think are lovely.
Time Leech.
I think the Cybermen strip is nice. That all bit's nice.
And Time Leech.
Time Leech is lovely. Actually, that was a really. I liked your Canyon in that. The sort of the Spanish lass who wears the Leela costume at the end.
Yes. That was Ruth Lorenzo from the X Factor.
Was it?
That's what.
Gosh, that is taking me back.
Wow.
That was a nice strip, and it was a lovely style. I thought you captured Tennant well.
Yeah, the artist was very good. The artist was very good. So,
was a long time.
That was a long ago. Yeah, it's 2009, wasn't it? 9, 10. Well, what 3 on sale now? Gareth Gavanna, thank you very much for joining us on this week's podcast with a K, and let's do a coaxial soon.
Yes, we should. Lots to talk about, including the Lost one, which was so good we decided no one could listen to it. And we're sticking with that story. Yeah. Yes.
Lovely. And so that's all from myself, James, and our special guest, Gareth Cavanna, discussing Warp Warp 3 and other things tangentially connected and directly connected. We'll be back next week where James and Brian will be discussing Doctor Who. Until then, it's goodbye.
Bye. Cheerio.